This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
My name is Carissa Chu. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Urology. It is my pleasure to moderate this next session, which will basically cover treatment for localized prostate cancer from A to Z. As many of you know, as patients, one of the most challenging decisions you have to make is what to do after that initial diagnosis. So fortunately here at UCSF, we not only have visionaries and leaders in this particular space, but excellent clinicians as well. So first up, we have Dr. Peter Carroll, who really doesn't need too much introduction, but I will do that anyways. He is a professor in the Department of Urology, former chair of the department, internationally recognized for his leadership in active surveillance. Among his many accomplishments, including over 700 peer-reviewed publications, he pioneered the adoption of active surveillance as a safe and effective management strategy for men with low-risk disease. In so doing, transforming management and significantly reducing risks of over-treatment worldwide. So without further ado, Dr. Carroll, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Let me just add to Eric's comment about Felix Feng. Felix Feng burned very brightly here at UCSF. I count as one of the luckiest days in my professional career that we were able to recruit him to from Michigan to UCSF. I want to point out, however, that his legacy lives on. Recently, working with the chancellor, Eric, and the Cancer Center, we were able to preserve this legacy and maintain his program, his research program. And actually, he talked to me before he died about his program, and we've been able to secure funding for that. So disclosure, prostate cancer is a spectrum of disease. There should be no demarcations between different grades, and it should be treated as a spectrum of disease. Treatment decisions are based, I say this all the time, are based on three things. One is the cancer itself, and you've heard how you, by imaging, genomics, histology, better define that. Age and health of the patient, how you treat someone who's got a three-year life expectancy because they have a bad heart or lung. Totally different than someone who's going to live 35 years. And then very importantly, as there are frequently different treatment options for men, your own personal preferences. And treatment, I always say the treatment should be based on the most current and detailed information available. Frequently, men don't have that information relayed to them. The number one thing patients will say to you after a year, after diagnosis treatment, if they say they would do one thing over again, is don't rush, is I think Dr. Cooper's idea about that second opinion makes a lot of sense. And for most, as I mentioned, as you'll find out today, for most things, there's more than one option for treatment available. I'm a very busy surgeon, treated thousands of patients with surgery. However, active surveillance is a recommended preferred form of management for low-risk disease, grade group one, and for selected patients with intermediate risk disease. I'll show you the data on that. UCSF has been a leader. We saw this coming many, many years ago, and we're a leader in the adoption and the validation of active surveillance as a safe option. Unfortunately, still, as Matt mentioned today, many men still undergo unnecessary treatment. Matt and I may talk about this a bit later, but many feel that grade group one disease should not even be called cancer. We'll see more data on this a bit later. Matt and I disagree on this point. This is data at UCSF. So what I'm showing you here is data at UCSF. This is surgical patients over the last 20 years. In blue, we have low risk disease, in red, kind of intermediate risk disease, and in the turquoise, high risk disease. You see that we have gone from treating low risk disease with surgery 20 years ago to selectively treating men only with high risk disease currently by surgery. The battle for prostate cancer will be won and lost on high risk patients. Only about 6% of our patients currently who undergo surgery here at UCSF have low-grade disease. These are usually patients who have large volume, abnormal genomics, or carrying germline mutations. This is different from many centers. Matt mentioned about 40% of patients still in the U.S. who have grade group 1 disease get treatment. I just saw some updated results. Even that looks like it's gotten a bit better. So what you need to know, this is 10 minutes here. This is what you need to know when you go, you think about making treatment decisions about surveillance, you need an MRI scan. I see too many patients going to biopsy without MR imaging ahead of time. So you need a good quality MRI scan, your age and health, you know, what's your past medical history, past surgical history, family history. As Jonathan said, you know, we're looking for germline mutations. You know, we have a strong family history of early onset breast, pancreatic, ovarian, or prostate cancer, especially lethal disease. You should undergo germline testing. It doesn't mean that you can't undergo surveillance if you're carrying a mutation. We have those patients, but we should know about it. PSA density, simple calculation. Take the PSA divided by the gland volume. That gives you a ratio. This is predictive of progression on surveillance. We've seen it over and over again. You want a PSA density below 0.15. The lower, the better. Volume, number of positive biopsies, grade of cancer, histologic subtype. I can tell you that the outcome of care is dependent. When you look at a pathology report, simply, you want to know the volume, you want to know the grade and histologic subtype. This should be available on all pathology reports. We're trying to get some large community hospitals to integrate this into the pathology reports. And as Cornelia mentioned, histologic subtype. This is driving, volume and histologic subtype are driving the outcomes of men with grade group 2, 3, and 4 cancers. And as Matt mentioned, this CAPRA score, this is, you can go to our website. This was been validated in tens of thousands of patients around the world. Easy to calculate. It is very good. It is, know your CAPRA score. Matt showed that. Okay, what to expect? I'm going to show you the most recent data from UCSF. This is 10-year outcomes. Now, this is a table. These are 10-year outcomes for men on surveillance managed here at UCSF. Very few centers can show this. And what I'm showing you here is for men who undergo surveillance for grade group 1 disease, how many get upgraded to grade group 2 or higher? Major upgrade, that means when you say I've gone to a grade group 3 disease or higher, I'll show you that most men who get upgraded, these small, 80% of patients who get upgraded, these are just going from grade group 1 to 2, as small volumes in volume. Very importantly, the risk of metastases, survival, and mortality. So at what to expect at 10 years here at UCSF, about 60% of patients will get upgraded over time. So you fall out 10 years at some point in time, the grade will go higher. The likelihood of a major upgrade is only 17%. So most patients who get upgraded by volume or grade, is, or rather subtle small changes, about 17% of patients at 10 years will have a more major upgrade. The risk of metastases is 2%, overall survival 98%, prostate cancer specific mortality less than 1%. Active surveillance is safe. We've shown that here at UCSF. Again, these curves here, the higher means the higher likelihood. What drives treatment is not just grade. So if you go to grade group 1 to 2, frequently around the country, that's considered an indication for treatment. But many of these are rather subtle, low in volume, low in risk. So not all the patients who get upgraded here at UCSF go on to treatment. If they have major upgrading to grade group 3, you know, primary pattern 4 or 5, these patients tend to get treated. The outcomes are quite good. So I tell patients, if I compare men, I've done a lot of surgery. If I compare men in the past who I treated for grade group 1 disease, I compare them to men now who get grade group 1 surveillance and progress, outcomes are the same. So the window of opportunity remains open for a very long period of time. What predicts for progression? Imaging. So you have an MRI scan here. Again, here's the prostate right here. This is the patient's right, left, big tumor here. PSMA PET is going to play an increasingly important role in local staging. So work done here at UCSF shows when you combine, done in here and in Australia, when you combine PSMA PET and MRI, you get better localization of the tumor site and extent. Increasingly, we're using this, Katsuyoshi Shinohara, when they recommend focal therapy. Okay, so these are the predictors of not progressing. The simple table, age. Younger patients actually have a lower rate of upgrading compared to older patients. Totally counterintuitive. So younger patients tend to have more favorable tumors than patients who are older. PSA density, the 0.15. Every time we look at it, it's an important predictor. Easy to get from looking at your imaging report and your PSA. Volume, okay. Low-grade disease, grade group 1 is generally a low-volume tumor. 85% of these cases are low-volume. The smaller the amount of cancer, the better you do. Grade group two, the outcomes of grade group two is driven by volume and histologic subtype. Those are very important. MRI, a negative MRI, or PI-RADS 1 through 3. Again, the PI-RADS scores are 1 through 5. So PI-RADS 1, 2, and 3 are different, predict for a lower rate of progression than men with high PI-RADS scores. Genomic testing, Jonathan touched on this. We have several commercial assays. More favorable scores tend to predict for not upgrading. And a simple negative biopsy. So if you want to go on serial biopsies over time, if you've had a negative biopsy, you were diagnosed, and another biopsy negative, and about 20% of the time this will happen. So for men with the diagnosed cancers on surveillance, we'll get another biopsy, about 20% of the time it'll be negative. Again, that predicts obviously for non-progression. Details, again, I wanna show this issue. At one time they thought that all high volume pattern grade group one disease need to be treated. We've shown that volume predicts for progression but does not predict for outcome after surgery. So even men with high volume, low grade tumors may be good candidates for surveillance. Younger patients, this is work done at UCSF, that actually younger patients have a lower rate of progression compared to older patients. I see a lot of young men diagnosed there just by almost accident in their 40s who have not completed their families. So these men actually are very good candidates for surveillance. So young patients actually do better in surveillance compared to older patients. Totally counterintuitive. Black men, controversies about this, because obviously in our active surveillance series, we have a lower proportion of Black patients than in fact the overall cohorts. So there we're a little bit more cautious, but work at UCSF suggests that you should not make a treatment decision based on ethnicity alone. What about grade group two cancers? So again, the higher is the better. So it turns out in this lower panel that the upgrading rates for grade group two are higher than grade group one, but many grade group two tumors on surveillance do very well. So again, what does well are lower volume, favorable histologic subtype patients. Histologic subtype, I can't impress how important this is. Cornelli gave a great talk on this, but this is driving outcome. So again, large cribriform intraductal cancers have more worse outcomes. The other thing is that it turns out that the adverse histologic subtype correlates with gene expression profiling 80% of the time. So again, I try and get this in all our patients. We've had patients from other systems, and I encourage those pathologists to incorporate histologic subtyping into their assessments. And if they don't know how to do it, they should come to talk to Cornelia to learn how to do it. New biomarkers, this was touched on recently. We have a big interest in AI, and I can tell you work led by Cornelia suggests that actually just taking the biopsy sample, we have an algorithm that reads that biopsy, can predict the outcome. You don't need a fancy genomic test to do this. This is what I call democratizing oncology. You make a diagnosis of cancer around the world on biopsy. We think you can take a picture of that biopsy, upload it to cloud, send to an expert pathologist, and using an IR algorithm predict outcomes. And she has shown this in at least two cohorts. And I think I borrowed this slide. I think I borrowed this from you, Matt, this slide here. Maybe not, maybe yours may have been better, but it turns out now what we wanna do is make active surveillance less burdensome, less intensive. So you can do that by risk profiling. So the patient on a treatment or a fusion biopsy, you know, high volume cancers, grade group two or higher, high genomics, PI-RADS 4 or 5, cribriform, volume. These patients, I'm not saying these patients are not candidates for active surveillance, but these are the patients who are going to need an early confirmatory biopsy. Different from a patient who's got favorable PSA density, negative biopsies, favorable genomics, MRI. These patients, we've actually decreased substantially the number of biopsies. And we think we will be able to characterize a group of patients who at the onset, we can say, you need no further follow-up. I mean, we have the data sources to start to ask these questions, but we may be able to predict for indolent tumors. We rarely see in the out years, and we demonstrated this, a biological shift. So we have seen a few patients who have low risk, and then we see this rapid onset of a higher risk cancer. That occurs in 1 to 2% of cases. And we think we can predict it. Again, who may need no follow-up? We think we can get to that. So I tell people active surveillance is about timing of treatment. Okay, so I've already showed you about one-third of men with grade group one disease, about 50% with grade group two will require treatment. Again, some men may never need treatment, but even those that do undergo treatment at the time of progression, you save them the morbidity and expense of treatment. So if you take a 50-year-old man, you can say, gee, you can go on surveillance, and in 10 years, if you progress, we can treat you for cure. That man is still benefited by a delay in treatment. And our outcomes, as I've showed you, are excellent. So I think active surveillance is a preferred form of treatment for really most all grade group one tumors. And I think some men with higher grade tumors, even grade group three, may be candidates based on volume, histologic subtype, and genomics and imaging. I've shown you that long-term outcomes support a safety. And I think the use of advanced imaging, better cancer assessment, make it safer and less burdensome to patients. I want to thank, it takes a team of people here. And I also want to thank, we have great support from radiation oncology and medical oncology for active surveillance program. Thank you very much.
All right, next up we have Dr. Sam Washington, who's be speaking to us about surgery for localized prostate cancer. Dr. Washington is a urologic oncologist, assistant professor here at UCSF, and his research focuses on addressing disparities in prostate cancer care. In addition to his work on race, socioeconomic status, and access to care and influencing prostate cancer outcomes, he's also an outstanding surgeon and colleague with an active practice both here at UCSF and San Francisco VA.
Washington. Everyone, thanks for having me. I'll be talking about surgery. I'll acknowledge my biases up front as one of those who performs the surgeries, but happy to talk about all the details of surgery itself. As we've discussed thus far, it really depends where you are on the risk spectrum when we talk about where surgery plays in the treatment paradigm for prostate cancer. I picked out some of my favorites up here. Ignore my own picture, that's a little weird. But for those who have prostate cancer that's contained within the prostate, surgery remains a good option. And really, as discussed before, when we discuss risk, that's when we need to talk about our treatment options. What are the best options for you to get not only the best outcome, but minimize comorbidities? Obviously, any treatment has a risk of causing some impairment in quality of life, time away from work, responsibilities, impact on function, and that needs to be part of the discussion, not just the PSA that comes after the treatment. Where is the prostate, or more often called the prostrate, especially at the VA? It sits in between the bladder and the inside of the penis called the urethra. So it sits right there, fused with both. And the prostatectomy is the way that we surgically remove it, prostate and seminal vesicles, from the prostate and the urethra, and then reattach those areas together. Now that ends up being obviously a change in your anatomy. And that proportion of the urethra that is removed has to be made up in terms of the gap. So we have to bring the bladder down to the urethra, complete that reconnection of the plumbing, if you will. And often when we talk about surgery, there's a question of whether or not we just remove the prostate and the seminal vesicles at the backside of the prostate, or if we need to remove the lymph nodes around the prostate as well. And that's really part of the discussion that's informed not only by your biopsy, your PSAs, and your risk stratification, but also all the imaging we discussed as well, or MRI, PSMA PET. All of that goes into that discussion. Now, how do we do prostatectomies today? Oftentimes we tell everyone we do it robotically, laparoscopic. And I have to always warn everyone, we're not at the phase yet where the robot is doing the work. It's merely a tool. So we still have a job for the time being. Now we do this through a large apparatus that looks almost like a spider on the left side. The robot allows us to control these arms and perform this large surgery through small incisions. That laparoscopic approach has been shown to clearly help in terms of recovery and time afterwards. I always have to remind people that even though their incisions are small and they're going home the next day, or in some cases the same day, they still had a large operation. So we have to kind of remind them of the fact that they are going to be recovering from that. Those small incisions, again, allow us to have much better improved return of function and recovery and pain management, time to get home rather than staying in the hospital for hours. What is involved? We talked about this a little bit. Again, removing the prostate from where it sits not only means detaching it from the bladder and the urethra, but also the nerves and the blood vessels that provide nutrition and oxygen and blood to the prostate and surrounding areas. And throughout the surgery itself, this is where we're monitoring the risk of bleeding. If there's bleeding, we're able to stop it surgically. Understanding that there are, the prostate does not sit by itself in a large empty space, but it's surrounded by other organs, other vessels. And part of the discussion when we talk about prostatectomy and that surgery is the risk of injury to those other things. Again, informed by our imaging, our assessments prior to the operation itself. And for most men, this requires just 23 hours in the hospital, basically going home the next day, making sure you're comfortable as well as your family are comfortable with the nice thick packet of reading material we give you before you go home. Now, because we're detaching the prostate from the bladder and making a reconnection, that connection has to heal. And we don't want that connection bathed in urine the entire time. So that's why we leave that Foley catheter in place or the tube going through the penis. Now, I tell everyone, you may not actually know who's had treatment or not because all of that hides underneath your clothes. So people are not tethered with this long tube. They're actually able to be functional and work around. But I do warn people not to lift any trucks or boulders for at least 4 weeks after surgery to allow all those incisions to heal. Now, why choose prostatectomy? A lot of this depends, again, on clinical risk and the workup that's done prior to treatment. So after diagnosis, that thorough discussion of everything that we've done thus far, also incorporating your preferences and concerns. Now, surgery in and of itself is often framed as kind of a one and done. Patients always ask me, well, if I have surgery, then I'm fine, I don't have to worry. But after surgery itself, we need to really understand what's happening. Part of the prostatectomy is the treatment afterwards, monitoring the PSA, which is now a good measure of the disease burden that hopefully is not there. The goal being to remove all of the cancer, the PSA be undetectable or as close as we can legally say to zero within 6 to 8 weeks after surgery. If the PSA rises afterwards, then we know that there's a concern for recurrence, and that becomes a discussion of what, how to best treat that, how to identify the area or source of the PSA. That is really based on our surgical pathology in that PSA. And for many men, surgery is the best option, particularly in higher risk disease. And discussion of that is always a heated topic between the surgery side and my radiation colleagues. Right? No, it's always fun. Yeah. Always fear for it. And men who have larger prostates, the surgery itself may actually serve two purposes, both removing the obstruction. Are these automated times? Okay. Removing the obstruction itself, as well as removing the cancer. So again, that is tailoring the treatment to your specific condition and setting, is always part of the discussion for prostatectomy. So why not choose prostatectomy? I guess now it's not time. Okay, so when we discuss prostatectomy, it all depends again on where this person is in their risks or concerns. There is a risk of incontinence or urine leakage after surgery. Your body just underwent a large anatomic change and now has to recover. Oftentimes this impacts not only the bladder, the urethra, the sphincter, the control mechanism right where we did the surgery, but the area around it. And that takes time to recover. And this is where we talk about after the surgery itself, men having to kind of retrain the area and recover and gain that urine control afterwards. And that's where we talk about urinary pads being needed, especially if men are lifting, golfing, doing some other activity. Managing that for them as part of the continued care after the surgery. Incontinence is not something that happens at one time, but an improvement over time. And we work with you after that constantly to make sure we understand how you're improving. And we know looking at our own data that men will become continent at over time, 12 months or even beyond, in that some men may just need a precautionary pad. Now, there are cases, and we tailor that based on each individual who may be at higher risk of that and how to support them afterwards as well. And that's where it really comes down to patient preference and considerations of the surgery. We know that the rates of incontinence can range dramatically. And this is where really, when we look at national data or large cohorts, we have these reported rates, but it's really tailoring based on the experience of UCSF and what we've experienced here. And understanding that people who have more significant leakage over time, we can support them with that as well. So it's not a one-time suffer in silence type of thing. Thank you, Matt, for the slide in the picture for this one. But something that evolves over time and we support you throughout that evolution. Now, erectile dysfunction, this is another aspect. I tell everyone things will not get better than they were during surgery. But the question is, how can we support you as this recovers over time as well? And oftentimes, nerve sparing when patients see me is often discussed as either all or nothing. And it's really a grade. And all of the imaging helps us understand how close we can get to the prostate and not leave prostate cancer behind, but also spare a lot of the nerves that are running on the outer portion, lateral aspect of the prostate. And most men will experience some change as we remove the prostate from the nerves that were connected to it. And then we follow them over time to see how that those nerves recover and also how we can support them in terms of maintaining erectile dysfunction. And again, this is something that does not just stop at 6 weeks after surgery, but rather improves and progresses over time as well. So this is a continual process. And we discuss about how much of that recovery happens for each person based on where they started. So if people are using medicines beforehand, I would not expect them to not need any medicines afterwards, but how can we support them with other modalities to get them back to an area that they like? And thankfully now we've been expanding that support even further. So penile rehabilitation, we've always discussed medications and other strategies that we can use to improve recovery over time. And now we've even rolled out a better clinic to focus on that recovery by starting before surgery itself, supporting men through and then afterwards to improve these domains as well. Now, the other thing that we often talk about is, okay, what happens after the prostate's removed or the prostate, what did it do? Now, orgasm unchanged, but no fluid will come out at the time of ejaculation. So oftentimes that is a shocker, no matter how many times we say this to patients. So we always make sure that they're aware. And we discuss that fertility in the sense where sperm is often delivered through natural paths is now disrupted because the prostate has been disconnected. So we often talk about banking in advance or recovery later if desired. And again, now we've removed part of the prostate and part of the urethra and have to reconnect the plumbing, if you will. And some people will see shortening in the penis from us reconnecting that path to fill in the quote gap from where the prostate was. And that's something that we often discuss and monitor over time as well. Very much case dependent. And in some cases, there may be a discussion of where surgery and radiation fit into that paradigm. And we have to talk about in those cases, the sequence of those events and how that may impact not only the preoperative or surgical management, but also the long-term outcomes after those treatments. Now, I made sure to at least include a few slides on how we're using PSMA PET intraoperative. And this is some work that's been led by Dr. Carol, Hao Wen, and others in our group to make sure that we can use this even during the surgery itself. I often tell people, I can't see the margins at the same magnification that Dr. Ding can during the surgery. So are there other ways that we can identify where the tumor is or where tumors may be left, where cells may be left over to improve our margin rate? So getting all of the cancer out during the surgery itself. So this is an active area of research, which really helps us understand where there may be other areas of disease and getting us closer and closer to using more of this intraoperatively, combining all of these modalities and technologies to provide better surgical management and surgical outcomes for our patients. We're not yet to the goggles, but one day. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Dr. Washington. Next, we have Dr. Julian Hong, Associate Professor in Radiation Oncology and a close partner of ours in the management of localized prostate cancer. His research focuses on integrating artificial intelligence and machine learning into clinical workflows to personalize treatment strategies, improve outcomes, and minimize side effects for patients undergoing radiation therapy. Thank you very much, Dr.
Thanks, Chris, and thanks everybody for joining us today. It's a real pleasure to be talking to you all. Let's see if I can get this remote thing to work. All right, well, I thought I'd start off with a little bit of a primer on radiation therapy. It can be a little bit of a black box to folks, usually conjures up thoughts of Marvel superheroes and whatnot. But many patients with cancer will receive radiotherapy at some point in their treatment course. It's a fundamental part of curing a number of different cancers, prostate cancer included. And often, as Sam mentioned earlier, can be used in conjunction with surgery, additionally with systemic therapies. And I thought I'd, we love to like physics in radiation oncology. So I just thought I'd throw a diagram here. Probably takes you back to some of your high school physics. But the idea behind radiation is that oftentimes we are using what are called photons, which transmit radiation. And the idea is that these photons or this radiation creates essentially DNA damage. And there are different ways to do this, whether it's by a direct action from the radiation itself or through an indirect radiation action that's mediated by other particles in between. And the idea is that this sort of more selectively impacts cancer cells than it does normal cells. And that gives us a little bit of a therapeutic advantage, which we've historically used to treat a number of different types of cancers. And so this ability for normal tissues to repair DNA damage between treatments in contrast to cancer cells is a fundamental part of how we deliver radiation, which has sort of been advanced over the decades that it's been used to take advantage of better technologies that allow us better spatial resolution and how we focus radiation, which I'll talk about a little bit today too. Radiation plays a role in a number of sort of different stages in the prostate cancer domain. Certainly, we're here to focus on localized prostate cancer, but I'll actually talk a little bit later today about the oligometastatic situation where prostate cancer has spread to limited areas outside of the prostate, but certainly other areas where we do apply radiation therapy. And it's frequently, I guess it's become a bit of a cliche that radiation is a little bit of an alphabet soup, but there are a number of different types of radiation, and in 10 minutes, I don't have time to cover everything on this list, but a number of sort of different domains that are covered here, radionuclides. I think there's, of course, an increasing interest in lutetium, PSMA, which we won't get a lot of time to spend on today. But most of the radiation that we'll discuss sort of fits into the external beam section here. So that's sort of split into proton therapy and photon therapy and a number of different subtypes. And then brachytherapy, which involves internal radiation sources that can be delivered in two flavors, both low dose rate and high dose rate brachytherapy. And this subquadrant, I guess not quite a quadrant, but this subsection of the graph is largely are largely the radiation options that we discuss and present when someone has localized prostate cancer. And since one of our brachytherapy experts is not represented on our panel today, I thought I'd just at least throw out a pitch for those guys. But brachytherapy is essentially internal radiation that can be done with permanent or temporary seeds. And this is just an example of an HDR plan. This is a little bit more of a procedural, but a sort of a more limited duration type of treatment that we use with radiation therapy. But I'll talk a little bit more about the external beam radiation, since that's kind of the most common radiation that folks encounter when they undergo treatment for localized prostate cancer. Again, in a bit of an alphabet soup, you'll hear a lot as you learn about radiation with regards to conventional fractionation. The standard technology for delivering conventional fractionation is IMRT or VMAT. It's actually used for all three areas that I'm discussing, but you'll frequently hear IMRT in reference specifically to conventional fractionation or moderate hypofractionation. And so I often tell folks that, you know, years ago, we used to do most of our radiation courses with a couple of months plus of radiation therapy. And then there were a number of trials that demonstrated that we were able to deliver a higher dose of radiation per treatment over fewer treatments. And so now very commonly you'll see what's called moderate hypofractionation for external beam radiation, which typically is 4 to 5 weeks of daily radiation Monday through Friday. And then naturally, once the treatment courses were shortened down to a month or so, there was sort of the question, well, a month's still a long time, guys. Can you guys do this even faster? And in that era, we started adopting a newer technology called stereotactic body radiation therapy, or SBRT. It's frequently also termed ultra hypofractionation, but those treatments go for 5 treatments over the course of about a week and a half here. So I thought I'd show you guys a couple of pictures to kind of demonstrate the differences in some of these technologies. One of my analogies, which I don't use as frequently as I did years ago, is the Death Star. The idea is that radiation, when it's delivered externally, comes from all sorts of different directions, and it's focused over one specific region. So, you know, before this was delivered with a technology called 3D conformal, and I often joke that as physicians, we're not terribly creative. So these radiation beams would basically come from four directions, the front, the back, and then the sides. And as you can see, there was a lot of scatter radiation back in that era. Eventually, intensity modulated radiation therapy, and then its subtype VMAT, which is what we use here, were developed where radiation could be backwards planned, where the radiation oncologist can define where the radiation needs to go and where we want to avoid radiation. And then from there, use algorithms to work backwards to generate a radiation plan where the radiation is basically focused in a specific area, and then low dose radiation is sort of more spread around. And that enables us to reduce the amount of side effects and the impact from the radiation on other organs. And, you know, as a number of folks have mentioned already today, you know, treatment for prostate cancer is a very highly personalized situation, but I thought I'd at least give some broad strokes as a starting point for what is often discussed for different risk strata of prostate cancer. On the radiation side, you know, technologies such as IMRT and SBRT are frequently options that are presented across all of the disease spectra. And then brachytherapy on its own sometimes a consideration in the sort of more favorable situations. And then as we increase in risk, we start talking about combining external beam radiation with IMRT, with brachytherapy. And then there's some considerations around hormone therapy. And these are just broad strokes. And certainly there are a number of nuances for making these decisions. You know, we start off with risk stratification, you know, sit down, discuss options, usually sort of separate options with regards to radiation and hormone therapy. And then we try to work in the preferences to try to come up with something that seems like an appropriate strategy on a personalized basis. Certainly discuss it with our surgical colleagues, sometimes heated Sam. And then we proceed to treatments. We continue to see you and follow up to both surveil the prostate cancer, but also to discuss side effects that may come up in the future. So I thought I'd present kind of in broad strokes what kind of the radiation experience is like. And this is sort of the typical care path. And we'll go through each of these steps as we go. So this diagram will be around throughout the rest of the slides. So the first step is what we call a CT simulation. And I usually colloquially refer to that as a planning scan because it's a more accurate, you know, name in today's era of radiation. There's the first part, which is gold seed markers that are done by our urology colleagues. These allow us to triangulate the prostate as we go through treatment. There's a CT scan, which may or may not be accompanied by an MRI. And these pieces of imaging allow us essentially to create a computer model of your body to design the radiation. We also oftentimes use some sort of immobilization to make sure the radiation is reproducible on a daily basis. And then probably one of the harder maneuvers that patients have to go through during radiation is bladder filling. And we often recommend that we fill the bladder, which allows us to get a little bit more anatomic and geometric separation because the full bladder gets farther away from the prostate and also pushes other organs away from the prostate to spare them from radiation. After that CT planning or the planning scan, patient goes home and then we do what's called dosimetry or radiation planning. We take all of the imaging, which may include a PSMA PET, may include an MRI, plus the radiation planning CT, and essentially trace out all of the where the radiation needs to go, many in the localized setting, for instance, the prostate, but also all of the normal organs, which is where a lot of the sort of operator dependency of radiation comes into play. There are often patient-specific considerations for what areas we want to avoid radiation and certain organs that we want to protect. Once we create that computer model, we work on designing the radiation plan with our medical physics team, who are all PhDs in medical physics, and other folks on our team who go to school specifically to design these radiation plans on the computer. And then in the bottom right-hand corner is just another example of how we design the radiation to create bogus plans. All this goes through a quality assurance program. I like to say that it's basically something similar to a dummy that we deliver the radiation on to make sure that what we program in the computer actually happens in real life before we start the radiation treatment. It's not quite a dummy. It's actually a glorified box, but same idea. And then the radiation treatment starts. I usually tell folks the radiation beam for most treatments is on for about 5 minutes or so. The entire process on a day-to-day basis, whether you're doing SBRT or a longer course of radiation, is usually probably about 15 to 30 minutes on a given day, depending on how kind of quickly everything is going. But the radiation itself is on for about 5 minutes. And the process is basically like getting a glorified X-ray day. You don't see or hear or chase the radiation. You won't glow in the dark, no superpowers or anything like that. And as you go through the process of radiation, one of the elements that we use specifically in prostate cancer is tracking with the gold seed markers. And so on a day-to-day basis, we review the image to make sure that everything is in alignment. We can also check where the rectum is, where the bladder is, to make sure those things are being protected while we're doing radiation. So this imaging during treatment is really important. And as the radiation machine is going around in a circle, what the beam is doing is changing configuration, basically to shape specifically to the target that it's aiming at. And from every direction, this beam is constantly changing to mold radiation to the right shape. And as we go through treatment, we see each other every week. And there are a number of side effects that we discuss in the short term, which are side effects that come up during radiation and in the period shortly after. Most of these side effects will show up kind of midway through the treatment and then peak a little bit after the treatment before they start to improve. And then there are long-term side effects, which come up months to years after radiation. Some of these can take several years. So for instance, rectal bleeding, which I have listed in long-term side effects, plateaus at about 7 years out. So many times, I think Dr. Washington was discussing sort of post-surgical side effects, which sort of improve after surgery. Radiation's a little bit different in its timing, where things can kind of show up over time. So it's very important to have consistent follow-up over time, both during and even years after the radiation. As you can tell, these side effects are all sort of related to organs that are close to the prostate. So the bladder, the bowel, the rectum are all areas that can be affected. And I think with that, I'll wind down. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Hong. So we're still catching up a little bit on time, but not doing too bad. I'd like to invite up Dr. Hao Nguyen. He's an associate professor in the Department of Urology as well, leads a very active lab looking at novel therapies for prostate cancer, and also co-leads our focal therapy program here at UCSF, and is, you know, charging ahead with this new treatment modality for localized prostate cancer, helping us refine patient selection. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Carissa, for the introduction, and good morning. Thank you for joining us online and in person. So I want to talk to you about a treatment modality without the side effects that you just heard. So no issue with dry ejaculation, urinary incontinence, bowel problem. So this could be maybe an important treatment modality for carefully selected patients. Let me go back here. These are summaries, so I'm going to talk about 5 points today. 10 minutes or so. So you see, you probably heard of this PROTECT trial, 15 years outcome. So if you have low or intermediate risk disease, no matter which modality you pick, active surveillance, surgery, radiation, you live about the same as your neighbor down the street who picked surveillance or surgery or radiation. Everyone had the same mortality. However, if you on the active surveillance arm, you can see that these you're twice as likely to get metastases and local progression. Now, treatment does come with these side effects. So is there a modality where we can decrease this risk of local progression and metastases and give you the same equal outcome in terms of mortality? So that's the goal. So here you can see the spectrum of disease. So for intermediate disease, most of the patient will pick surgery or radiation. And then some patient who has recent group grade 2, recent 7, may not be comfortable with active surveillance. They may pick surgery. So there's a modality where we just focus on treating the disease part of the prostate and spare the rest of the healthy tissue, and that's focal therapy. And at UCSF, we have offered three ways to do it. One is cryotherapy, high intensity focused ultrasound, and irreversible electroporation. And focal therapy is also approved in the setting of relapse in terms of radiation current. So in the past, the argument against focal therapy has been around the limitation in accurate staging, and we don't have a good way to predict how aggressive the cancer behaves. But now, over the last 10 years, improvement in terms of staging with PSMA, MRI fusion biopsy, as well as genomic tests to predict the behavior of the cancer. So now more adopting focal therapy. So who are the candidate for it? So localized disease, intermediate risk, recent 7, 4-3 in some selected cases. And then a tumor in one area of the prostate. So you can see here, one area, you can have a quadrant or one side of the prostate. We can do a Hodgkin's stick ablation if you have a contiguous tumor in 3/4 of the prostate. So the ablation, let me go over the some of the consideration in picking the right patient. So most patients should have an MRI fusion biopsy. We want accurate information about their cancer or the extent of the cancer before we offer this. And also determine what type of energy we use. And that's based on the location of the tumor. Posterior tumor, I tend to pick high intensity focused ultrasound if that's done through the rectum. Anterior tumor, typically we pick cryotherapy or IIE. Tumor that is close to the urethra, we often pick IIE because we can ablate the urethra without cause damaging to it. And also we look at calcification of the prostate. Ultrasound has limitation on that. So for calcification, we often offer IIE or cryotherapy. Brachytherapy seeds is another consideration that may interfere with sound, but may not interfere with freezing. So so as I said, it depends on location, we pick the energy source. So at UCSF, we have, this is an example of high intensive focus ultrasound. Using sound wave, you could focus the sound wave to 1 millimeter of tissue and heat that up to about 184 degrees Fahrenheit. And that turns into that kind of coagulate and destroy that tissue. And over time, that becomes fibrotic area and it shrinks down. So that's how you have to focus ultrasound. And then we have IIE. This is a patient undergoing IIE. Here, we insert this electrode around the tumor and deliver about 2,000 volt of electricity in that area, about 2 square centimeter tissue. And that basically breaks the cell apart and destroy it. So the guidelines. So focal therapy is not yet considered a standard of therapy in most guidelines. For the NCCN guideline, is only an option for radio recurrent cancer, not yet as a primary therapy. AUA guideline, expert opinion, clinician can select patient, well-selected patient can be offered focal therapy. European guideline said it should be done in a clinical trial setting. So what are some of the ways that focal therapy can fail? So imaging or staging is important. So inadequate margin here. So here you have a tumor that is extending beyond the capsule. If you fail to recognize it and you offer focal therapy, you may miss treating that cancer at the margin. The other one is the biology of the cancer. Tumor that's well perfused, they may wash the heat away, and you get decreased and heat may not react enough to destroy the tumor. Or you can have a missynchronous tumor along that side or opposite side that was not detected on biopsy. The other one is the inadequate staging. A patient may have cancer elsewhere in the prostate that you don't know, that MRI or CT scan may not see. So I'm a big proponent of using PSMA PET early on, even in the low intermediate risk setting to look for these, what we offer them. So, and what's I want to talk to you here is our UCSF experience. What about the outcome? So in terms of side effects, we all know that it has minimal or no side effects. However, how is it perform? How does it perform? So here's our data on cryotherapy. Dr. Xinhan has been doing cryotherapy for many years. Here's about 95 patients. So failure-free survival, this is defined as needing a surgery or radiation. So at 2 years, 94% of patients did not need surgery or radiation for whole gland treatment. And there is a slight decrease in their sexual function. Their urinary function remained unchanged before or after cryotherapy. And here's a data on high-intensity focused ultrasound. This is the data of 135 patients who had recent 77% of patients, 23% of patients had grade group 3. And then in terms of CAPRA score, 44% has low CAPRA, 49% intermediate, and 7% high. All men get a biopsy at 12 months. So you can see here, 46% didn't have cancer or low grade cancer. The other 41% had inferior recurrent, 13% had outfield recurrent. Now, if we look at this is at 2 years after the ablation, 84% of the patients did not need whole gland treatment, so they didn't need surgery or radiation. 16% needs surgery or radiation. So, but when we look at sexual function, no change. We looked at any complication higher than a grade 2 or so. We didn't see any of that. We didn't see any change in the urinary or bowel function. So in our data, we think that we show that the recent grade group had a high genomic risk predict for recurrence. So we're doing a lot of research on that. So the endpoint. So some of how do we follow these patients after ablation? PSA is not reliable. We know that our study and others have studied. So typically we track PSA, but it can fluctuate. So if the PSA goes down, we still do a biopsy to confirm that there's no cancer, if there's cancer that needs to be treated. If there's two consecutive rise in PSA, and we typically do a biopsy sooner than 12 months to see if we have cancer outside the prostate that was missed or the cancers that survived the ablation. And then imaging. So MRI right now is the gold standard to follow the patient after. We're doing a lot of research on hyperpolarized MRI. It may be better than the 3T MRI. And also PSMA PET, integrate that into surveillance follow-up of this patient. So everyone gets 1 year systematic biopsy and also biopsy the area that may be visible on MRI or ultrasound or the other area that we ablate before. So what do we do after? So we have post-treatment here. So we have the cancer, we decrease the risk and they continue on surveillance. If the risk remains the same, we often offer another round of ablation or surgery or radiation. If the risk goes higher, then we offer surgery or radiation. And the good thing about focal therapy is that when you pick surgery, if you have a recurrent or the cancer didn't work with the focal therapy, you can get surgery or radiation. That shouldn't have much impact on the way we do surgery on or radiation. So you don't burn any bridges, basically. So here's an example of a patient, a 69-year-old man with Gleason 3-4 that was diagnosed in 2019. He has, you know, fully low risk based on genomic tests. So he went on to active surveillance. And 2 years after on active surveillance, his risk goes up to Gleason 4-3. His Decipher test also goes up. So we elected to do focal therapy, and we treat that area. You see there, the post-HIFU biopsy downgrade his risk again back to just microfocus order. So this patient, we decrease the risk. We didn't cure his cancer, but we decrease his risk, and he still keep his sexual function, urinary function, bowel function, and chin. So I was going over this with Dr. Carroll yesterday. He said focal therapy is intended to mitigate risk, and we're looking at that right now, how much risk we can reduce with this focal therapy. So we know that it's the data is solid on preserving sexual function, bowel function, urinary function of the focal therapy. And inferior recurrent, you can see his ranges. Ours is about 40%. I think this is high. We are doing many extensive research on how to improve that. And in summary, the effectiveness of focal therapy hinges on careful patient selection, monitoring the patient after, and also use all advanced imaging. So I'd like to conclude with acknowledge Dr. Carroll here. He's instrumental in giving me the task to lead a HIFU program a few years ago, and Dr. Kasudo Sinahara, who's been doing CRI for many, many years, way before me. Dr. Kasudo is instrumental in getting the HIFU machine to us and the rest of our team.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.